Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Today, I'm thrilled to have as my guest Luis Alberto Urrea, and we're going to be discussing his novel, The Hummingbird's Daughter, which has recently been published by Little Brown. And it's a novel which, if you complain about reading the same story over and over again, or if you're looking for a writer who knows how to tell a story, The Hummingbird's Daughter is the type of novel you're going to want to read. So first of all, Luis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Casey. Thanks for having me.
Luis, this book completely took me by surprise. Miriam Parker at Time Warner, Little Brown, gave me an advance copy back in January and February and said, Casey, I think you ought to read this. And I read it and I was just mesmerized. And that led me to an exploration of some of your other work. And before we discuss The Hummingbird's Daughter, let's talk just a moment about your Border Trilogy.
All right.
That you wrote, in particular Nobody's Son, which I think if someone reads The Hummingbird's Daughter and wants to find out more about Luis Alberto Urrea, I found Nobody's Son to be an excellent source. So if you would, tell us a little bit about the Border Trilogy that you wrote and what you felt like you accomplished with that that helped prepare you to write The Hummingbird's Daughter.
Well, you know, it began with Across the Wire, my first book, which got its genesis from working in the Tijuana garbage dump with a relief group, a group of missionaries who were taking food and medicine and water to the people that pick garbage, you know, maybe 5 minutes from the Mexican-American border in San Diego. And it seemed to me that nobody in San Diego, which, let's face it, is, you know, the richest real estate in the richest state in the richest country in the world, had any notion whatsoever that children within sight of downtown San Diego were dying of the cold at Christmas, were eating dead dogs to survive. They had no idea. And I was working with this group and standing around in this garbage and this, you know, piles of burning dead horses and a scene out of Dante. And the pastor that I was working for had said, you know, you should write about this. Nobody who writes books has access to this world you live in. And so I started keeping journal notes and ended up with quite an extensive series of notes. But I faced 10 years of indifference trying to publish that book, and it was rejected nonstop for 10 years. And when it was finally published, it was 1993. And when it came out, it got quite a bit of attention. And you know, I found it really gratifying, and I'd gone on and I did a book of poetry and then a novel. But it occurred to me a couple of years later that NAFTA was happening, and it would be interesting to see the effect of that change of culture on that same border world that I had written about and Across the Wire. So I did the second book, which was By the Lake of Sleeping Children. And, you know, a couple of years down the road after that, I thought, well, I'm done with the border, but it occurred to me that I had been still thinking about the border a lot and realized that I had written two books of other people's stories about the border, and I thought, well, you know, perhaps it would be illustrative to tell the story of what happened to my family. So I wrote Nobody's Son as a kind of a portrait of the cross-border American life. You know, I was born as an American citizen, born abroad. That's what my birth certificate says. So on one side, it's all Mexican, you know, Tijuana birth certificate. And on the back, there are government stamps saying that I'm American. It's kind of an interesting bit of foresight on my parents' part to avoid, you know, immigration struggles later. So I thought, well, okay, that's the trilogy. I'm done for sure. That's it. I'm finished with the border. And, you know, then in 1991, Little Brown contacted me, which was an astonishment in its own right, and recommended that I look into this Devil's Highway story. So it's turned into a kind of a border project now that there are four books, and no doubt down the line I'm going to end up writing more because it just is a topic that won't go away. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it really put me in tune with the particularly amazing culture that exists both in the United States and in Mexico all along the border. Mexico, for generations, has disowned the border as, you know, a sort of a non-country, a non-Mexico. And certainly the United States, I don't think, knows what to do with the border. Maybe turn it over to Cormac McCarthy
let's talk a moment before The Hummingbird's Daughter, and I'd like to tell the listeners that part two of this interview will be airing in September, and in part two we'll spend a lot of time talking about The Devil's Highway, which Mr. Urrea wrote and was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in 2004 and is going to be made into a film. So we'll be discussing The Devil's Highway in part two of this interview. So that will air in September. So we're going to keep the focus today on The Hummingbird's Daughter, but you can go ahead and read The Devil's Highway because it's a fabulous, fabulous piece of work. Luis, in Nobody's Son, there was a paragraph that you wrote that jumped out at me, that when I read the Hummingbird's Daughter, you said, "Gringos have a strangely difficult time with the bizarre details of the daily life of Latinos. People scoff at personal testimonies of wonders, but they love to read them. They love to read them in novels from Colombia. To us, however, magic realism is basically reality."
Right.
And that kind of, I thought that kind of permeated the work of The Hummingbird's Daughter, doesn't it?
Certainly. You know, it's been interesting to me because a lot of the critics have been likening it to García Márquez, of course, and many of the sources have talked about magic realism, and one of the crazier reviews said that I had somehow reinvented the genre of magic realism, which all was really wonderful and exciting to me, yet was a little bit baffling because all of the things one would consider magic are the actual recorded details and events of Teresita's historical life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the stuff that was invented by me was the regular quotidian details of daily life. What did they have for breakfast? What did they wear? What's it like being a Mexican cowboy? That was all imagined, but all the, you know, the flights of amazement, fancy, and miraculous stuff was all actually witnessed by people and left in a written record. So that was interesting for me because I felt like it was kind of the reverse of magic realism in a way. So I know that García Márquez has said before that, you know, when you see the things that one sees in these little villages, they're very magical and taken for granted, and that becomes part of the fabric of life. So I didn't want to create a kind of a precious text with magical stuff going on, but I wanted a text that revealed the sacred that happens, you know, even in lives of misery and squalor.
Mm-hmm. And don't you think it's a bit lazy just to compare The Hummingbird's Daughter to Márquez?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, I didn't have that in mind at all when I worked on the book. So, one of the lit bloggers has pointed out that he feels that that's kind of laziness, that people aren't thinking deeply enough, and it's shorthand. But, you know, if anything, I wanted to write, perhaps like Malcolm Lowry, though hopefully a little more accessible than Under the Volcano.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Teresita.
Yeah.
The protagonist, the Hummingbird's Daughter. And the Hummingbird's Daughter is a wonderful blend of fact and fiction. And tell us a little bit about your relationship to Teresita, the Hummingbird's Daughter, and how this all evolved.
Sure. Originally, like I said earlier, I was born in Tijuana. I was raised back and forth between San Diego and Tijuana, and I didn't really understand much difference between the two until later. But as a little boy, I would spend a lot of time in Tijuana at my grandmother's house with my aunts. It was a very matriarchal household with all these powerful, semi-eccentric, crazy women. And magic realism, as you know from Nobody's Son, did abound in that house. There were ghosts and various bizarre goings-on in that house, and it was in a neighborhood that had a castle at the end of the block that some eccentric had built, and there were people down the hill who had a bear chained in their backyard. So it was sort of a strange, you know, slightly John Irving in Mexico place with a trained bear.
Mm-hmm.
But in that house, they would always tell these stories, and one of the stories that they told often was that I had a Yaqui aunt, and that this Yaqui aunt was a healer. She could heal the sick, and that the Yaqui aunt had returned from the dead, and then it would evolve into the Yaqui aunt could raise the dead and could fly. And then final versions of the story. The Yaqui Ant had been a great leader of the people during the conquest, and that she died sometime, you know, at the end of the Aztec days, and that her body had been preserved in a cavern sitting on a crystal throne made of quartz guarded by Yaqui warriors. And all of that was pretty head-spinning, as you can imagine. I thought, wow, this is incredible. And much of the family myth revolved around what an interesting family we were, right?
Sure.
We were constantly, I mean, my aunts were all working in tuna canneries and bowling alleys, and my dad was working in the tuna cannery and driving a bread delivery truck. So I think, you know, any kind of tale of Urrea's grandeur and glory was greatly valued.
Sure.
And so that was a favorite kind of a legend. And years later, while I was doing this work, it became Across the Wire. I was also working part-time as a bilingual TA at a Chicano Studies department in San Diego at a community college. And it was there that the professor I worked for recognized my name and said, well, you're related to the Saint of Cabora. And I thought, who's that? And he said, you know, the Saint of Cabora. And I said, no, I don't know who the Saint of Cabora is. I realize now that I hadn't even been told her name, because nobody in Tijuana knew the name. They just knew there was some Urrea saint. So he pulled out a text, which was by Kerry McWilliams in the book North from Mexico. And there it was, you know, a written essay about my great aunt, Teresita, I found out was her name. So I Xeroxed it, and I passed it out to my relatives, and I was the big hero in the family for having done research. So, you know, that slight bit of praise for doing research kind of got to me, and I started making it a habit to look things up about her as much as I could, now that I knew that she was a historical figure. And so that really began the actual book learning part of it, where I hit archives and libraries and historical societies and microfilm archives, anything I could to find information about her. And I would, anytime I'd find something about her in a book, I would then raid the bibliography and pursue all of those sources. And if they had sources, I would pursue those sources. So it became kind of a branching tree of research in that way.
Mm-hmm. And we might mention that this novel was 20 years in the writing. Is that correct?
Yeah, it took a long time because, you know, partially I didn't know quite how to tell the story. And I vacillated between fiction and nonfiction for several years, and I started to feel like, you know, this would be my life's work on some very deep level. This would be my ultimate project, and I felt that the best that I could do as a writer, for me, at least my generation, I wanted to write a great novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I had mentioned earlier, you know, Under the Volcano or something. I wanted to be able to try my hand at writing a novel, a grand novel of the kind that had changed my life as a young reader. So, you know, that became my crazy quest. And, you know, I did the actual research and archival stuff from 1985 until 1995, and it continued after 95. But in 1995, I moved to Arizona to get closer to the Yaqui people and to learn about her. Certainly not firsthand, since she had died in 1906, but as closely as I could get to the root of her story. And that began a long period of studying with shamans and medicine women and so forth, curanderas. And that gave me a whole different perspective. So part of the problem, I think, of the 20-year process was my own kind of initiation into their world and having these people trust me enough to tell them, my own way of trying to figure out how to tell that story to you, the reader, but also these other responsibilities, you know, of trying to know her story completely, but then it meant having to understand the Yaqui's story, and it meant having to understand Mexican history, you know, so it just kept, it was like a strange origami, you know, that kept unfolding and showing new pictures as I went.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the time that this takes place is a very interesting time in Mexican history, the Porfiriato, the time of Don Porfirio Diaz, and that plays a very important role with Don Tomas, the the patron, and he kind of bets the wrong horse in the political arena in Mexico at a very critical time.
Right.
And how did you weave the history of the Porfiriato into the novel, The Hummingbird's Daughter?
Boy, you know, that was tough. And there were whole passages that were just awful. I mean, one of the problems, I think, in writing historical fiction is these expository passages, right, where you have to explain history to everybody. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to have to keep stopping and writing these political essays to teach people what's going on. And I thought, that's not working. And, you know, and I certainly didn't have the benefit of being somebody like Charles Dickens. You know, it wasn't within my style of writing to be able to say, dear reader, ponder, if you will, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
I had to find an organic way to fit it into the text. And I think the way that it occurred to me to write about the religious parts of the story and the miraculous parts of the story also held true for the political parts of the story, in that I was trying to narrate this story as seen by all the participants at the moment. Whether I believe or don't believe what she believed, for example, doesn't really matter. The point is to represent her life as honestly as I can and her belief systems as honestly as I can and let you make the choice. So there were moments then when political things happened, and I realized that the people, you know, the community around her, they're the witnesses to this stuff ultimately. And so there are moments when news is delivered to them and they don't understand. They're trying to understand politics themselves. So there are moments when they're told, we have to move, we have to leave, there's trouble. And so I tried to make them kind of a collective witness for the readers who are reading the book, and that way try to slide some things in, because some things are really important. For example, that moment when Don Tomas, in real life, it's true, he backed an anti-Porfirio Díaz candidate for governor of Sinaloa, and that candidate won. And Díaz immediately sent the army, and they recounted the ballots, and miraculously, oh, there was a mistake. The guy lost. Of course he lost. But once he had lost in the recount, then all of his supporters were in serious danger of dying. And so Tomas really did pack up his ranch and flee to the state of Sonora to get away from the Sinaloan repercussions of what had happened. And one of the interesting historical things is that he was the first guy to take domesticated bees into Sonora.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
The bee thing is going on in the book. And they really did travel with the cattle drive, but they also had wagons. So they had a bee drive as well as a cattle drive, which I thought was kind of delightful. But that's a very important piece of news. And other little bits of history are important to me. For example, that the Yaquis who attacked at one part of the book were Catholic. People don't always know that it's a Catholic tribe with a strong Catholic tradition. You know, so there, I just had to find ways for the characters themselves to find these things out so that you can find those things out with them.
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe perhaps my favorite character in the book is Huila.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the novel, we get the impression that, or Huila is not only a curandera, she's a teacher, and you tell us that it's part of a child's job is to learn,
right,
to study, and Huila and Don Tomas educate Teresita, and Huila is a fascinating character, and I loved her little medicine pouch, too.
Yeah.
So, how did you use her? Was she kind of a method of advancing the story and educating Teresita as she grows into womanhood?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think Huila and Tomas and his friend Aguirre are the two forces that educate Teresita. I think Teresita was formidable because she not only got an indigenous education in herbs and so forth and healing, but she got a Western education in reading, writing, and politics and so forth, and that really came together into a really remarkable mind, you know, pre-revolution. The thing about Huila, everybody's favorite character in the book is Huila. I mean, over and over again, people talk to me about Huila, Huila. And it's interesting that if you look in the history of this story, there really was a Huila. She really was Teresita's teacher. She really was Don Tomas's head of domestic staff. She really was the head midwife and herbalist on the ranch. But beyond that, the Mexican historians ignore her. And you find find this over and over again, you know, that the history of Mexico is written by, or at least has been, it's changing now, but it's been written by men, and mestizo men, you know, and they often discount indigenous stuff, and they certainly discount female stuff, and you see fairly disparaging things written about Teresita herself, and nothing written about Huila whatsoever. So I had this main character who had been erased from the history. And I despaired for a while. How am I supposed to write this? It's one of the things that stalled me. How do I write this woman's education without knowing? And I'll tell you that when I went to Tucson in 1995, I got to know a cousin that I didn't know I had named Esperanza. Esperanza Urrea. And Esperanza is a healer, hechicera type. And she was raised by her maternal grandmother, who was a full-blood Mayo medicine woman named Maclovia Moroyoki. And Maclovia Moroyoki lived in this village called El Jupare, where Esperanza had grown up. And Esperanza, through her father's side, was descended from Teresita's family, Jose Maria Urrea. And Maclovia, on Esperanza's mother's side, was descended from the Mayos, who are cousins to the Yaquis, their greatest war leader, whose name was Moroyoki. So all of a sudden, you know, I had this strange nexus of two very powerful bloodlines, Moroyoki and Teresita's, in this one family. And as Esperanza took it upon herself to try to teach me some of the things Teresita would have been taught as a little girl, which was a whole interesting, you can imagine, twist, you know, that the women decided I could learn women things, which was quite an honor to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still moved that that happened. But as Esperanza was trying to teach me, she would tell me more and more stories about Maclovia Moroyoki. And I realized, finally, it took me about a year, but I realized that what she was really doing was giving me the gift of Huila, that she was saying, this is the old tough healer woman. This mm-hmm. is the way you learn. You know, mm-hmm. this is woman power.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an incredible, you know, it was a priceless gift. I mean, that gave me the novel, absolutely. Having Huila personified like that
That's wonderful.
Was the ultimate gift. And once I realized that, you know, I was saying on my reading tour, I would tell audiences, oh, you know, I was despairing about how do I write Huila? And I would tell Esperanza, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to write Huila. And she'd say, wow, that's so interesting. You know, Maclovia would say, blah, blah, blah. And I'd say, wow, that's incredible. But what am I do about Huila? And she'd say, well, you know what Maclovia would do? Blah, blah, blah. And after a while, it finally got through that she was trying to tell me, this is the way to do it.
Sure.
And Maclovia died in 1963 when Esperanza was still quite young. So Esperanza felt that her teaching was not complete, but it was quite vivid to her. She, you know, carried it with her whole life. And one thing she did, which has been very powerful on tour, I didn't know it would be, but she gave me a portrait, a photograph of Maclovia, and she gave me Maclovia's shawl, her little yellow reboso that she used when she was doing her final healings. And she said, take these to the people so they can meet her when you go out. So certain audiences, if they're really receptive, I put out the photograph and I put out Maclovia's shawl, and the response is just—it's galvanic, it's electronic. You know, people—it's like lightning hits them, and many women, interesting, no guys, but women, come up and ask me if they can lay hands on the shawl.
Mm-hmm.
So that's turned into a really intense, strange, I think, beautiful thing.
Yes,
it's mysterious to me, but people feel so close to her, you know, so in some ways I feel like it was my ritual to bring Maclovia back to the world more than anybody. It
sure.
wasn't my intent at the beginning, but it seems to have brought Maclovia to people.
That's wonderful. You know, Luis, one of the things that you do in The Hummingbird's Daughter, which it's a very funny novel, and there are scenes where I was just laughing out loud. My wife would say, you know, what are you laughing at? And I would say, well, you've got to read this novel because there's no way I can explain, you know, like why this one section is funny. But the engineer, Don Lauro Aguirre,
yes.
is really a very comic character. And he gets a little religious power during the novel and kind of really, really enjoys it. And When you've done your tour, are most of the readers are they telling you how much they enjoyed the humor in the novel?
Yeah, a lot. You know, it's been really funny because the tour has been very well attended, which is nice. And sometimes the crowds are quite big, which is also really nice. It's a little disconcerting, but they're also extremely funny. And I've noticed that people come, because frankly, you know, I've made a career of writing books that people really don't want to read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, books about people dying in the desert or dying in the garbage dump.
Right.
All this. But this time, people have come and they've come ready to laugh, which is really exciting to me. And you know, they carry the happiness with them when they come in. So yeah, people I think really like the humor a lot. And
yeah.
You know, it's just the truth. It's the truth about, I think, Mexican life, but certainly all of our lives. Any life that has a certain rural element to it, anyway. You know, there's a lot of humor in it. There's a lot of earthiness. You know, there's a lot of dirt and stink in it. And you know, that's I think what makes the story to me sacred.
Yes.
I don't mean a religious story. I mean a sacred story.
Right.
In that we all have things that are sacred to us. You know, even if it's a garden or if it's an old pair of shoes or if it's, you know, there are things that carry story and a kind of personal holiness to us outside of religion. And I think that writing that book for me was a process of discovering that very thing. It was some kind of Zen training in a way, you know, to have this experience directly of the world. And you know, one of the things that saved this book was that it didn't used to be funny.
Oh, really?
It was very serious and somber. And you know, I had given a draft to my wife, and I always say this jokingly, but it's true, that when we were first married, she didn't know that if you're a writer's wife, you know, your job is to tell a boy, that's really good stuff. So I gave her the manuscript very proudly, and I said, here it is, my masterpiece. And she read it, and, you know, a couple of days later, she basically said, I don't really like it that much. And I thought, what? You don't like it? I was devastated.
Oh, absolutely.
But she was right. And she said, basically, you know, you're trying to convert me, man. You're trying to force me to feel awe. And I, you know, I'm not checking into this book to feel awe. I'm not reading a Lives of the Saints book. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute, she's right. Of course she's right. You know, you can't force people to feel awe. In fact, people recognize cheesy stuff when they see it, whether you think it's full of awe or not. And so we had this little joke that when I was revising it, everywhere where I had the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing these huge hosannas, I would move that out and in my mind bring in James Brown. Because, you know, the book is deeply funky. But that's their life. She didn't live a life sitting on mountaintops seeing rays of light. She lived a life of mud and blood and discomfort and heat and bad smells.
Absolutely.
Poverty. And I thought, if you can find sacredness in that mud, that's true. That's true sacredness. And part of it is funny.
Yeah, I think it's in Nobody's Son. You have a passage where you talk about when you were young, the guys were licking battery cables. And
yeah.
And then you said, but that shouldn't surprise you because Mexicans will put anything in their mouths.
That's true. That's true, man. You go into these shops and you find, you know, not only saladitos, you know, those brine-soaked prunes, but, you know, we'll buy little cellophane packages of tiny, horrible shrimp and some kind of orange grease, and we'll eat it. So, you know, we'll put anything in our mouths, I think. But again, that, you know, that's a product of a long and deep struggle, right?
Sure.
A long, deep poverty, man. So, you know, when I was a boy in Tijuana, you know, I didn't know we were poor, but now that I look back on it, you know, I realize, oh, God, I came from a dirt street in Tijuana and a house with stinky outhouses out back where I was dying of tuberculosis and several poverty diseases at once. You know, it's hard for me to believe. I'll be standing in front of some crowd in Seattle or someplace, and I think, how is this possible that this has happened?
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's that kind of humorous miracle that permeates that book, I think.
Yeah, and we might mention that Teresita Santa Teresa, she drew very large crowds when she when she began her healing. She large numbers of people came to see her.
Yeah, they did. That it was part of her downfall in that, you know, she attracted so many pilgrims, sort of against her will. I don't think she had a sense of how powerful, you know, the thing was that she was toying with. But when word got out that she could heal, more and more and more and more people came her way. And I think it was partially, you know, desperation of the people suffering under Diaz, but partially also this kind of millennial madness that started taking over in the late 19th century. You know, I mean, the events that happened around Teresita, including a huge government massacre of 300 indigenous followers, happened very close to the time of Wounded Knee in the United States. And her phenomenon happened, you know, if not concurrently, within a year of Wovoka and the Ghost Dance. And some of the elements that will come up in the sequel to this, because, of course, Little Brown asked me to write a sequel, and I don't know if it'll take 20 years again.
They're hoping not, right?
Yeah, no, they put a time limit on me just in case it's time. But, you know, one of the things that happened to her followers is that they believed that if they pinned her photograph on their shirt, they wouldn't die. Nobody could shoot them, which is very similar to the ghost shirts of the Ghost Dance, where warriors thought if they wore this blessed shirt, bullets would be stopped. And, of course, they found out, to their eternal surprise, that it didn't work.
Yeah. Luis, you mentioned the sequel. Let's talk for a moment about your editor.
Yeah.
Because Jeff Sandler, who must have been just a saint to you during the writing of this book, because I can't imagine the manuscript that you were sending him, how it was edited into this final form.
You know, I've got to tell you, he is, you know, may all writers work with him. That's all I can say. But I hope they don't, because I want his attention for me. But, you know, I feel like he and I have some kind of one of those magical editor-author relationships from the 30s and 40s that don't exist anymore. And if it weren't for his focus, I don't know that my books would be as good as they are, frankly. I mean, it was Jeff who thought up sending me out to investigate the Devil's Highway. And when I turned in the manuscript, at first I thought he'd gone crazy, because it was a sea of red ink when I got it back. And I thought, well, my career is over.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of reading this guy does, the kind of editing he does, you know, he moved the whole section of Devil's Highway that begins the book out of the middle and put it at the front. And he would say things like, you know, one sentence on page 165 needs to move to this place on page 38. That kind of reading that completely rewove my words and didn't get rid of hardly any of them. Now, Hummingbird's Daughter, I will say, was rather large when I turned it in.
Yeah.
And he cut a lot out. And at the time, I thought, I'm dead. You know, it's lost everything that I've... But then I realized what he had done is he had found places where I had been redundant, or where I was, as he said, didn't always trust the point I was making. And he was trying to let me find the point I was making and trust the reader with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just the most amazing, piece of editing twice now. And so I'm very, very, very happy and confident in his hands. And I've said before, and I'll say on your show, if he left Little Brown, I would do everything in my power to follow him.
Mm-hmm. You know, Luis, that's wonderful to have a relationship like that with an editor. And one of the things I was wondering when I was reading it, did he help you with when you come to a phrase that you would express in Spanish, and the decision to leave it in Spanish or change it to or translate it to English? Was that something you discussed with him in terms of what you should leave in, what you should take out?
No, he trusted my take on it. And you know, part of the thing about this novel is that in some ways it's a magic trick, in that the narrative, although written in English, is actually in Spanish, if you think about it.
I mean,
you know, in reality, everything that happened in that book happened in Spanish. And so I wrote it to partially put
caught that.
That are left in Spanish, partially just to keep the illusion flowing, just a little way to touch down, you know, on the as if you're swimming in shallow water and you occasionally touch down on the bed of the lake to push yourself off. And I tried to keep it to phrases that were fairly obvious in the text, what they were, sort of self-explanatory.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I thought if I spent too much time stopping and translating or reiterating things too much, it would start to seem artificial. And, you know, I think both Jeff and I were working extremely hard to remove anything from the text that would disrupt the trance. I wanted it to be one of those books that you entered like a dream and you
yes.
didn't want to get out of the dream.
Yes.
And so, you know, things that would disrupt the flow, I had to go even if I wanted to keep them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is that narrative dream, and it does flow unbroken. And for a novel of its length, which is right around 500 pages, that's no small accomplishment. Now, to wrap up part one, Luis... When you saw the final galleys of The Hummingbird's Daughter and started thinking about writing a sequel, did you think about stepping in front of a train?
Well, you know, oh gosh. Part of me, when it was done, I was numb.
Yeah.
And, you know, as my wife says, it was the first time in all these versions of this book that she'd ever seen me smile. Because I thought, wow, it's finally worked, at least enough for me to let it go.
Yeah.
So yeah, the thought of doing the other book is overwhelming and is frightening. I mean, one of the reasons I chose this book, in some sense, the second book is much more full of incident and wild stuff that you're not even going to believe.
Mm-hmm.
On a much more kind of personal political level.
Mm-hmm.
And this book was the one that had very nebulous sources, but you see, that gave me a lot of leeway as a narrator to follow the timeline but be able to expand out into it. And I'm not sure in the next book how much room I'll have to move. I'll have to learn that as I go.
Well, we'll let you rest a little bit with The Hummingbird's Daughter. Luis, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a delight.
Thank you, Casey.
I cannot recommend The Hummingbird's Daughter highly enough. It's one of these novels that comes around not very infrequently, and I've recommended it to many of my friends, and they've all called me afterwards and thanked me. So I look forward to part two. We'll talk about The Devil's Highway and Luis' continued success with The Hummingbird's Daughter.
Thank you.